Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Question: have you become a member of the Unfound discussion group on Facebook yet? On Monday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Unfound podcast channel on YouTube, yours truly hosts a live show in which I talk about some of my personal life, I discuss recent true crime news, and I preview that Friday's episode. But I also take questions from the audience. Since I know many of you have not yet checked out the live show, today and for the sixth time, you will get to hear me answer a long list of questions I've received recently and over the past year. I'm Ed Dentzel, and this is Unfound. Unfound news. Regarding updates for the TV shows in which I will appear concerning Janelle Matthews and Steve Pankey, the Dan Abrams episode has still not aired, and I've not yet been given a date. And the series where I went back to Greeley, Colorado in December is, to my knowledge, still due to be played in August. Next, update episode 17 will be coming out the last Friday of this month. Lots to talk about. I may have to divide it into two episodes. That is how much has gone on in the past 4 months. Finally, I did my first live show using my tablet as the camera while I was on the road with my brother Brian in his RV this past Monday. It worked out well. Good to know this will be an option for the future. Okay, since this is Q&A episode number 6, I think many of you know how this goes, and in fact, these Q&A episodes go very much the way the update episodes go, in that I don't have a script in front of me. And in fact, for these questions, except for some specific questions later that I will answer, I don't have anything written at all. So all of these answers you are going to hear are right off the top of my head. Although I've looked through the questions and determined how I'm going to answer them, I don't have anything written down. However, given that this is recorded, I'm guessing that some of these, maybe I started into them and then kind of got off track and had to redo it. But except for some questions later in which I will tell you that I'm reading from some notes, other than that, all of this is off the top of my head with no notes at all. So please forgive the ums and you knows and pregnant pauses, etc., that you know do not happen in the regular Unfound podcast episodes. In addition, I tried to mix these up between disappearance / true crime stuff and non-disappearance true crime stuff. I tried to. So we kind of, at least a little bit, go back and forth just to keep everything kind of fresh, I guess. Okay, let's get started. I think there are 20-some questions here. I did not count them, but I know they're over 20, but there's not 30 of them. Let's get started. First question, and this comes from a listener who obviously knows that I used to live in Las Vegas. I lived there from 1998 to 2011, 13 and a half years, worked in entertainment most of that time. And the question is, being that the Tropicana is being dynamited and destroyed, completely leveled, so I think they're going to put a baseball park in there, do you have any memories of the Tropicana? And the question is, yes, I do. A very, very specific one. As some of you know, I used to be an independent filmmaker. I worked with some men and women from about 1999 until about 2006 before I decided that I had had enough of that and really did not enjoy the collaborative artistic process. Too many, how do they say, too many chefs in the soup, something like that. And it just got to me after a while. So maybe it's, I guess, no surprise to all of you that I just do this podcast by myself. Although I have assistants, we work on other things together. But the podcast is done by me and me alone, except for, of course, some of the assistants, of course, finding guests to appear on the podcast. But all the writing and recording and interviewing and researching and everything else, that's done by me. Which, given how I acted when I was with a bunch of filmmakers, should be no surprise to anyone. I am an only child in most senses of the word. But the year was 2001, and we had a movie premiere scheduled. Pay very close attention to the date. September 13th, 2001. And we were showing the movie in the big showroom at the Tropicana. The way I remember it is we had some sort of person we knew who worked there in management. And it was the night that the show that was usually in that showroom was dark. And so it was available and we could rent that showroom out and have all the cast show up, the production crew show up, a bunch of families and everybody were going to be flying in to show this independent movie at the Tropicana. But unfortunately, it was 2 days after September 11th. And in addition, the movie that we made, this independent movie, had to do with a bombing. You can't make this stuff up. In which a building was leveled. Was part of it. That was the main part of the plot, trying to figure out who blew up this building and why. And so the premiere of this movie, the showing of the movie on September 13th, still happened. But before it, myself and the director of the movie had to get up in front of everybody and made sure everybody who was in attendance understood that this movie got made well before September 11th. And it's just an unfortunate coincidence that September 11th happened on a Tuesday. And then we had the showing of a movie about a bombing on that Thursday, 2 days later. And of course, because of everything that happened, no family could show up. My parents were supposed to fly in. A bunch of family members of the cast members were supposed to fly in. None of it happened. We still had the premiere, but of course, the people who showed up, it was like one-third or half of the people who were supposed to be there. So, I mean, in retrospect, the movie wasn't very good, and it really didn't affect anything regarding the distribution of the movie or anything. Anyway, like I said, there are other reasons I'm not a filmmaker anymore. But that happened at the Tropicana Casino and Hotel on September 13th of 2001. I can remember... Like a couple days being all excited for this premiere. Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. Everybody's going to come. It's going to be fantastic. Going to have a big party and everything. And then, of course, everybody's mind immediately went to September 11th. And then we're thinking about, well, what's going to happen. We're going to have this premiere. We decided to go through with it anyway, which was probably a mistake. But we did it, and it played, and then really that was about it regarding that movie. It never went anywhere. And like I said, it's not very good. The plot is great, but we certainly probably should have given the money involved and everything else. We probably should have kept it to something a little simpler than a bombing and a complex plot and all these different locations and everything else. The thing, you know, we learned. And we didn't learn it, unfortunately, that lesson when we came out with another movie in 2005, which was also kind of mystery caper type of movie. And it once again involved a bunch of locations and everything else. We should have never done either of that. You live and learn, but once again, there's a reason I'm not a filmmaker anymore. And most of those people who I worked with still are. They're still doing stuff in Las Vegas, and very happy for them. But it was a bunch of things put together, but it was mainly, yeah, a lot of times I don't play well with others. So yeah, that is my memory, as you can see why, of the Tropicana back in 2001. But what I will say about the Tropicana, it's getting dynamited or demolished, raised, R-A-Z-E-D, here in 2024. It should have been done 20 years ago. Even when we had that premiere there in 2001, it was looking dated. Of course, you know, the Mandalay Bay is virtually across the street that had just been built. And of course, the Bellagio was almost brand new. The Venetian was going up right around that time. Tropicana could have been demolished 20 years ago. And I think that would have just made as much sense then as it does now. It was outdated way back then. But so that is a memory, the main memory. Was I in the Tropicana for other reasons after that? Yeah, but you can see why, of course, that would be the main memory for me for the Tropicana. Next question, and this kind of goes right in line, although certainly in a different direction, the opposite direction. That's the Tropicana memory is a very sad one, kind of all these expectations and then all that, you know, that happened. It's the worst timing ever. But I did get a question. What is your favorite memory, your best memory from your time in Las Vegas? And I'm given the standards of this podcast overall, I have to keep this PG. So there are things that can't be talked about ever, never, not on this podcast ever. But you know, my best memories of Las Vegas are all of the years that I worked at Star Trek The Experience. I think I've said, and I think this is a question that's come up, or a topic that's come up on the live show on Monday nights, and you should be listening to it, by the way, if you're not. The live show I do on Monday nights on YouTube and Facebook starts at 9 p.m. Eastern. But the version of Ed Densel you hear these days, and all of you have gotten to know, is the version that was really crafted in those years at Star Trek, those 4.5 years. I would say my opinion, it was like I was quite a bit of a different person before then. And I think working there made me a better person. I think it really gave me a better personality because I worked with so many great people and people with fantastic personalities, very outgoing, very personable, could talk to anybody. And it really shaped, it continues to shape 20 years later, who I am. And I gained some of my best friends, believe it or not, and they're women of all time, working there. And so that continue. Granted, it's not, maybe the person asked this question, they're maybe looking for a specific day or maybe just a few, couple of days. And if I had to get away from PG rate, I could certainly do that. But there really, I don't know, was any one particular day. It was just those years. And the funny thing is you really don't, maybe some of you feel this way too. You look back and you don't realize how good something was until it was over. And kind of like that Cinderella song, you don't know what you got until it goes gone. Of course, that's about relationships, but that's the kind of way it was. Don't get me wrong. While I was there, I knew this is unique and it's kind of a cushy job and it's fantastic and I'm a Star Trek fan and everything else. But there were a lot of people who worked there at the time who complained. And I wonder if they're complaining now 20 years later. I doubt it. They probably look back. And even me, though, I wonder, did I really enjoy it as much as I could have? But it was still pretty fantastic because of what it continues to give me now in 2024. Because when I started there, I wasn't even 30 yet. And now I'm 53. And it's still, working there still is giving me gifts every day. And I mean that. From once again, the person that I became, along with now all of the people who came into my life during that time. It's a gift that keeps on giving. And you even know one of them. I remember a few years ago, I appeared on my friend April Hebert's podcast, Think It Through. Remember that when I appeared on her podcast? She's one of those people. You know, she's one of those people who I think very highly of, had a lot of great times with April at Star Trek and her Christmas parties and everything else. So that is that memory, once again, of things that I can talk about publicly, that is one that just is fantastic. It's so unique. And people would travel from all the world to, you know, to see us perform and everything. It was just fondest memory, PG memory. There you go. From Las Vegas. Next question for this Q&A episode number 6. I didn't realize it was number 6. I was thinking it was like number 3. And then I started going back. I was like, oh my goodness, this is number 6. I didn't know. All right. What's the worst part and best part of your job?
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Doing the podcast, and this person also says looking forward to the Q&A episode. I will start with the, is there a bad part of doing Unfound? Yes, there is, like any job. I suppose even if you hit Mega Millions or Powerball for $1.3 billion, there can be downsides. People coming out of the work, the woodwork, saying, hey, remember me? Can you loan me a couple bucks? You know, there's a downside to that too. So I don't, so I'm very realistic regarding this. The worst part is that it's clear to me, and this just, not just goes for me, but I just think the true crime genre, it's obvious that law enforcement does not take us very seriously. And I would like to think that I take the work that I do as serious as anybody who takes their work seriously. Whether you're a teacher, an engineer, an accountant, whatever, a professional athlete, I take my work as the, interviewing people, finding people, covering these disappearances as well as I can, as seriously as anybody takes, I think, any job. The difference, and I've brought this up, I don't know, maybe it's come up in the live show, but there are certainly people within the true crime genre, and I don't know how many people that is. When I say the true crime genre, people who actually host a YouTube channel or a podcast, something like that, who are certainly good enough that they could be valuable resources to police departments and the FBI and whatever, sheriff's office, whoever, regarding disappearances and is, or serial killers or whatever else. For me, it would just be disappearances. I certainly believe what I've learned over the last 7 years, 7.5 years, would be helpful to people, who were doing law enforcement work. There's no doubt in my mind. And I've made the comparison that myself and a few others, you know me, I'm very picky about this stuff, but me, myself, and a few others, if we were college athletes, like, for example, the March Madness just finished, if we were the versions, and I think we are kind of, like Caitlin Clark from Iowa, or some of these other players that were in March Madness, and of course they're going to get drafted, whether into the NBA, WNBA. There are people out there whose job is to look out, scouts for those NBA teams, WNBA teams, who are looking for people like Caitlin Clark. We want her on our team. She's going to get picked number one. She can help us. The problem with law enforcement, at least in the United States, I'll just stick to my country, even though I know that Unfound has listeners all around the world. I'm not going to be an American telling people in other countries what their law enforcement does. But here in the United States, law enforcement is not looking for any help. They're not looking for people outside of law enforcement who can help them. This is the worst part of my job, because I think if myself and a few others, hosts, channel hosts, podcast hosts, that if we were doing something else, if we were college athletes or we were students at MIT and we were near the top of our class, that there would be companies or sports teams or whoever else just clamoring, just breaking down doors to hire us, recruit us, draft us, and everything else. But in law enforcement, they aren't looking for people like that. And this is a huge flaw in law enforcement in the United States. I get it. The FBI, for example, I think you have to have a college degree to become an FBI agent, or maybe even have to have your master's and everything else. But you could have your bachelor's and master's in anything. Likewise, to become a sheriff in most counties in the United States, you don't have to have a criminal justice degree. That's a political position. As we discover, like with Nathan Lewis in Hemphill County, you're just a politician like anybody else running for an office. Yet law enforcement is not looking for people who, I mean, I'm certainly not an amateur. I'm a reporter. I get paid to do this, of course, through all the various means that Unfound makes money. So I'm not an amateur, but I am a professional reporter. And I've gained a lot of knowledge regarding disappearances that I certainly think could help law enforcement in solving some of their disappearances. But law enforcement isn't out there looking for people like that. And why? I think it's a variety of things. I think mostly it's just ego. I think it's arrogance and everything else. I think in the live show, within the last few months, I talked about how I talked to a retired FBI agent, and she readily admitted that the police departments out there, the reason they don't ask the FBI for help is because they're afraid the FBI will come in and solve their cases for them. And they're afraid of looking embarrassed, being embarrassed. That's a true story. So that's the worst part. Knowing that I can help a lot more, and the people who are in positions who can control that just aren't interested. And I would say if these police departments were actually running a business, any type of corporation or something, you know, and they had this attitude, they would have been out of business a long time ago. So that's the worst part. Knowing that I can help a lot more than I can, and just being rebuffed here and here. You know, there's no FBI or no sheriff's office or police department is not banging down Ed Denzel's door saying, you know what, Ed, I think you can help us with some of these disappearances. If I were a professional athlete scoring 20 points a game and getting 10 rebounds, I'd have every NBA team contacting me. This is the big difference. Worst part of my job. Best part of my job is knowing that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I've said this before, that my brain goes very well with information and complex information. being given a lot of facts and giving a lot of statements and everything and being able to go through them and just really center, being able to, it's not easy, but to really pick out those points that are the main ones, or to go through a bunch of information, pages and pages and pages, and be able to pick out the contradictions very quickly. For some reason, my brain is very good at that. Don't ask me to manage people. So knowing that my brain is right in line with what I've chosen to do here is the best part. And, I admit, going back to the independent filmmaking and some other things, I thought that was what I was supposed to do. But, you know, I never felt totally comfortable with that, with these other things. And then kind of this came along, and I've always been interested in disappearances. And my brain was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, this is what my brain is good at. And so that is the best part of my job. Then, of course, trying to help these people using your brain power for good. Because we know how many people use their brain power for bad. But using your brain power for good is a spectacular thing. Next question. Do you think any famous people listen to your podcast? Have they ever contacted you? Have a famous person ever contacted you and said, you know what, Ed, I listened to your podcast? That has never happened. First of all, the second part first, that has never happened. That somebody, whatever kind of fame we're talking about, whether it's an actor, actress, a director, or a famous author, or a famous athlete, or musician, or whoever, politician, whoever, leader of a country, nobody like that has ever contacted me. However, if you're out there, I'd love to hear from you. That would be, we could just keep it private. We could keep it private, certainly. If some famous person, Academy Award winner, Super Bowl winner, whoever, were to contact me and say, Ed, you know, I listen to your podcast every week. You're doing a fantastic job. That would just be the biggest hoot ever. But if any famous person would be worried that I might blab that, if you're listening out there, famous person, I would not do that. But I can tell all of you truthfully, that's never happened. Now, the first part, do I think any famous people listen to the podcast? I do. It's just, if only for a percentages thing, an odds type of situation, in that Unfound is a fairly popular podcast, not the most popular. It's never going to be the most popular true crime podcast because we're in a very niche type of true crime topic. But certainly famous people are no different than non-famous people. They have their own interests and they have their own hobbies outside of their work, whatever has gotten them famous. And we know how much all of you take an interest in true crime. So it just makes sense that there are a lot of famous people, no matter how they got famous, that also take an interest in true crime one way or another, some sort of genre. Maybe it's just serial killers. Maybe it's, I guess you could put like conspiracies kind of in that as well, UFOs or whatever. And so I have to believe there are some out there that take an interest in disappearances and they may have a lot of time on their hands. Maybe if they're traveling, if they're part of a sports team flying from city to city, what do they listen to? What do they watch? Or an actor on a set. There's a lot of downtime there waiting for everything to get set up. What do they do? Well, I think it's very possible that they listen to true crime. So I'm inclined to believe there are some famous people that listen to Unfound or have run across the podcast and listened to it. So the answer is, do I think famous people listen to your podcast? I do. Have any of them ever contacted you? Though the answer is no. I'll say it again, though. If any of them do want to contact me, just to say, hey, I'm a big fan, that would be like the coolest thing ever. And I promise I will not tell my audience who you are. Although I may tell my audience that some famous person contacted and said they were a listener. he or she was a listener, but that would be cool. Next question. Does my dad listen to my podcast? He once in a while brings up how when he's going like through YouTube on his smart TV, he'll run across like my live show or something like that. And his friend Dottie, who is tuned in, I think, to the live show once in a while, well, I know has told my dad, because if you listen to the live show, you know that I do talk about my dad once in a while, that she has passed along to him that I've mentioned him. But no, my dad's not a big true crime guy. My mother certainly was. I mean, Unfound will never have a bigger fan than my mother was. She listened to every episode, and she and I would talk about the disappearance, of course, going way back to the beginning until she died there in late 2018. But we would talk about the disappearance that was featured that Friday. But my dad's really not into that, and I don't expect him to be. I don't feel bad about that. Anybody, not just in my family or friends or whoever, whether they listen to the podcast or not, I really don't care either way. I'm not looking for any validation. I don't need any of them to say, man, that was a great episode. As I've stated many times when it has come up regarding reviews that Unfound got like way back at the beginning, which were horrible, I just finally decided the podcast gets done no matter what. It gets done no matter what people think of it. So I really don't care if friends and family, of course, I love all of you listeners. Thank you for tuning in. But when it comes to the people who are closest in my life, whether they want to listen or not, I don't ask. They don't bring it up. If they don't bring it up, I just take for granted they're not listening. They got other things to do. And really, it doesn't bother me at all. In fact, given this question, I really don't even think about it until I'm asked about it. So, but I don't hold against my dad. He's really not into this stuff. And of course, as we know, a lot of people aren't. Next question. And this came actually from a guest, a prior guest of Unfound. How many hours of training do state troopers in the police academy receive in missing persons? The answer is easy on that one. Zero. Zero. I've done this. I've actually gone to a variety of universities who are prominently known for criminal justice programs. You will not find one class, one course. Now, granted, I didn't go through every one, but it's been a while. It's a few years. 10, looked at like 10, 12 different prominent. Just looked up what are some of the criminal universities that are best known for criminal justice programs. Just went to them, went through, because you can find all their curriculums online, very easy to do. Not one has anything to do with missing persons cases or disappearances. Not one. So when I've gone to Florida Atlantic or Nova Southeastern or some of the other schools that I've attended and spoken to those criminal justice majors, that is the only talk they will get in their entire, 5 years program. That's it. So the answer is zero as far as schooling. Now, after that, I think any seminars that people who are already police officers, investigators could go to kind of get additional training, continuing education, we might call it, or something like that. The answer is also zero. None. Not important. Now, why is that? Why do they get a lot of training in forensics and people's rights and all of those things in contrast to disappearances? I think, first of all, we have to remember that disappearances that last longer than a week are fairly rare. That doesn't mean they don't have an impact on society, though. I cover disappearances because they're important, not because they're common. It's a very important distinction. All right, I cover disappearances, I feature them, I work on them, because I see the damage that they do to societies and people and families, not because they're common. These disappearances that we feature in Unfound that are over a year old are somewhat rare, but they're still important. But I think that it's just not a concern because police look at that, well, it's rare, and we'll just deal with it. We have domestic abuse calls happening every day. We have robberies happening every day. We're getting calls about sex abuse, children being abused sexually every day. So we're going to concentrate on those. And so we'll just have to figure it out when a disappearance happens that lasts longer than a week. To me, that's not good enough. You're responsible for everything. You really are. And so you have to be prepared. I'm not saying that anybody in law enforcement needs a whole semester, although I think at the college level that would certainly be helpful. But once you get to be an investigator, I'm not saying that a person need to take several months off of his or her career to be educated on disappearances. Not at all. I think I could do it in a week. I think I could teach these people in a week, but going back to our prior question, they're not really looking for people like me. So the question is zero. And this is the reason that what they do, as all of you have seen, well, if a disappearance happens, we'll give it to this homicide investigator over here. We'll give it to this person who does vice over here. The problem is nothing that those people have learned in any of those disciplines, homicide, vice, car theft, robbery, none of that's going to help them with missing persons cases. Zero. Zero. And so that's why we end up talking about, well, why did the police not seem to know what to do after a few days? Well, this is the reason. So the answer is zero. It's very sad. Trying to change it. Don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. But if we're going to make a dent in the number of unsolved missing persons cases in the United States, it's gonna have to change. Because I think the public, if they were more aware of the numbers, this would change. But the public isn't, except for all of you, because the public doesn't take an interest. And, you know, a lot of people don't take an interest in disappearances until it happens to someone in their family. And I think that we have to have a higher level of consciousness. Is that the word? Our consciences have to be a little more refined regarding this. We can't just be concerned about what happens to us. What about other things happening to other people? That's when it will change. Next question. I was curious if you could discuss episodes where the outcome was different from what you expected and how lessons learned can be applied to old and new unsolved cases. Spectacular question. I hope all of you know by now that I don't mind admitting when I was wrong regarding the outcome of a disappearance. Having said that, you should know that my correct rate is up above 90%. But yes, I have gotten some wrong, and I'll tell you about a couple of them. And I don't think anybody should be surprised that these are disappearances that were featured very early on in Unfound's existence. Whereas the ones, like even the ones, maybe except for Bo Man from last year, and Brandon Roberts too, pretty much I have a... As it has gone on from 2017 to 2018 to 2019, 2020, etc., I've gotten more and more of them right. And I'd like to think that I'm continuing to learn, but I still realize there are going to be a few where I get them wrong. But the ones that come to mind that I got wrong, Crystal Morrison, once again going way back to, I featured that disappearance way back in 2017. I actually thought that she was murdered. I thought that she had called to get picked up, but maybe she called her former drug dealer to come bring her drugs, and I thought she might have done something out in the parking lot, and she overdosed, and then that guy covered it up. We now know that's not what happened. We now know she went down the street. Something was going on. It was a combination of being sick, the temperature outside, being severely underweight due to her prior addiction. Maybe she did fall back into her addiction. And then we know that she was found not too far from that Shell station. And nobody, including her family, believes that it was foul play. So I got that one wrong. Another one I got wrong was Esther Westenbarger. I surely thought that her brother, who is a shady guy to this day, was involved in her disappearance. Instead, we now know that probably she was drinking and driving, and that she was on the wrong road, went through that stop sign, went right into that retention pond and drowned in her car. And it took 10 years to figure that out. Now, what I will tell you now, though, had we covered the, if those disappearances had not gotten solved, and they both got solved in, I think, 2019, I think, the way I remember it, very close to each other, coincidentally. I think if those disappearances had not been solved, and they were still eligible to be covered on Unfound Now, that there would be no doubt in my mind that I would pick, you know what, I think Crystal Morrison walked off. She was seen down at that Shell station, and then something happened. She walked off. I know that wouldn't be a very satisfying resolution or theory that I would have for many of you, but we now know all these years later how often that happens. The people who have an addiction or had an addiction or were sick, they do walk off and they do die out in the middle of nowhere and there isn't foul play. That was not something that was fully didn't appreciate how often it happens when I started Unfound back in 2016. Now, of course, with Esther Westenbarger, what has changed since the covering her disappearance to now, of course, is now all these YouTube channels that go out there and with scuba divers, they go out and look for cars in bodies of water. And I think that certainly this is where I would go. Have we covered Esther Westenbarger's unsolved disappearance last year, if it was still unsolved in 2023, I certainly would have come to the decision of, I think she's in her car somewhere in a body of water, and it very well may be that I might have actually picked out that retention pond on a map. But back then, it certainly seemed, given that her brother's so shady, and being that she was with him that night, you know, did he steal her car because he was jealous that she was retired and she had this money and everything? We now know none of that was true. And this is, you know, this is, I think, should be a lesson for many of you who maybe too quickly default to the foul play angle. We have to remember, according to my stats, along with a couple listeners who I've had look at the you know, really educated listeners from the think tank, between 60 and 65% of Unfound's disappearances are foul play. And that sounds like a lot, and it, I guess it is, two-thirds. But that also means that 35% of them aren't foul play. And so we've covered 320-some disappearances. Let's just make it 300. That means that 100 of the disappearances, at least, that Unfound has covered are not foul play. It's a considerable number. Just strange to me how quickly sometimes the people want to default to foul play. But we're all learning here. And I think had Esther and her car not been found and we'd gotten to and had her daughter on as a guest, that I would have said, you know what? She's in her car and she's in a body of water somewhere. And it very well may be before Unfound ever got to cover it. It very well could be that one of those diving companies would have found out about Esther's disappearance and they would have started looking around a body of water and gone into that retention pond and found her. Very possible. Very, very possible. So those are a couple outcomes that I got wrong. Brandon Roberts from last year got it wrong. That's one of those where I don't know how you get it right. When somebody else ends up with his phone, the odds of that person being alive are very, very, very slim. He was alive. And then Bo Mann, I certainly believed that he was deceased. Certainly didn't think that it was foul play. Could be open to the idea that he overdosed, but not because of Joanna Good or anything. But I don't think anybody could have suspected that he would be found a quarter mile away, just lying out, not necessarily in the open, but he was certainly outside on pavement in this little courtyard of this abandoned building. Nobody could have predicted that. on top of the fact that all of his friends and family had gone down there around there looking for him. So I thought he was deceased. Certainly drugs were prominent in my mind. Just could not have predicted the location, though. In contrast to Daniel Villarreal, kind of the same thing. I thought that he ran off and was deceased somewhere, but I don't know how you predict that he ends up in somebody's backyard in a little outhouse or whatever it was. I don't know how you'd ever predict that. There's just going to be things that are so rare that there's no experience or statistics that can be used to predict that, you know, really, really specifically. We may think that, oh yeah, the person's dead or the person overdosed or something, but trying to narrow down, well, where that person is, and then the person ends up in some place that's really odd. I don't know how you do that. I don't think we'll ever be able to do that unless people start getting GPS implanted into their brains or something. But I'm still open to the idea that there are many disappearances that we've featured on and found that are like that, that aren't foul play, that people who have journeyed off, walked off, ran off, and they just ended up in places that people wouldn't search or people don't have access to that area. I'm certainly open to that idea, for example, with Jason Landry's disappearance. So I hope that whoever asked this question, I hope that answers the answer you were looking for. Certainly have gotten some wrong, but man, it makes me feel good that I get a lot of them right. Next question. This is interesting, being that I just came back from a two-day RV trip with my brother Brian. Are you like your siblings at all, or are you all different? Oh boy, being that I have to, I don't know if my they never bring it up, so I take for granted that my siblings, my two brothers and my sister, don't listen to my podcast. Once again, not offended by that at all. All right, if they were doing some TV show or a podcast, I don't know if I would be listening to them either. Of course, might just depend on what the topic is, what they're doing, maybe. Am I like my siblings? It's interesting to me, for some of you, maybe, well, that's kind of a weird question. For all of you who don't know, I have three full biological siblings. We all have the same mother and father. However, I was given up for adoption. They were not. And they're all quite a bit older than me, like 20 years, just on the average, 20 years older than I am. I was a little bit of a mistake, and hence the reason I was given up for adoption. Then I was raised as an only child by myself, completely spoiled, by Ed and Loretta Denzel. And then I got to meet my biological family. It's like 30 years now. It was April of 1994. We were all spring chickens. It was fantastic. So, and I've known them since. I've hung out with all of them for extended periods of time. I've gone on vacations with my sister, Diane, and her husband, her son and his kids. I've gone on trips with my brother Brian back when I lived in Las Vegas, and he would go through as a truck driver. I've hung out quite a bit with my brother Michael. For example, he lives in the Pittsburgh area. I hung up quite a bit with him before I moved to Las Vegas. So I've experienced being around all of them for extended periods of time. And it's interesting, what you find out is genetic, and what you find out is environmental. I think it's safe to say that my biological parents, John and Suzanne, very different from Ed and Loretta Denzel. And doesn't mean any of them bad or great or anything else, just different. Different personalities, different the way they looked at life, different choices that they made in their lives, and everything else. And that certainly shows, I think. But some of the things that you would not think that are genetic, all of us have a lot of the same mannerisms. We kind of walk the same way. We stand kind of the same way. We talk the same way. I would say one of the big things, though, if I may say, one of the big differences, I think, between my siblings and me, even though you may say, well, Ed, you're a heck of a talker. You can talk for 2 hours on that live show and everything else. But if you were to meet me in public, I'm really not much of a talker. But I think that's – I'm very much a listener. I think that's what allows me to do these interviews, which is a question coming up here. Whereas my brothers and my sister are talkers. They love to talk. they know how to talk, and they're very – they're all educated, well-spoken, great English and everything else. And that's another one of the things is that all of us – pretty sharp. There's a reason, for example, that, you know, the trivia team that I'm on with my brother, Brian, we do so well. Now we have a lot of other smart people on the team, surely, but there's a lot of information bouncing around in my brain and my brother, Brian's brain that we can access a lot of different, experiences and all the reading that we've done. And that's another part that my, even though I'm not one, and maybe this is the other big difference, my three siblings are voracious readers. They read a lot of books and novels. They've read way more like fiction novels than I ever will. And they listen to audiobooks way more than I ever will. So they're very well read. So it all makes us all pretty sharp. Pretty sharp brains. And in fact, I will tell you that even my dad has said, and I love my parents. Parents, obviously smart people too. But my dad has said more than once over the years that, you certainly got those, the Joyce brains. He doesn't know what kind of brains had I gotten. He just, of course, is kind of joking around what kind of brains I would have gotten if I were my parents' biological child of Ed and Loretta Denzel. But like I said, they're both very educated. Both were teachers. Mother was an excellent musician. Dad, very smart. He's in 87. He just kicks butt on crossword puzzles like no 87. I'm sure you're old out there. But we do talk about that. So regarding my siblings, I would also say that if I could talk about my brothers for a minute. My sister too. No, my brothers, my sister's think much more like I am, a little more introverted. And whereas my brothers, social animals, they love getting together with a big crowd. They love getting together with guys that they went to college with, guys that they went to high school with, and going on the, meeting guy trips and things like that. I'm not like that, and I would not say that my sister Diane is like that either. I'm a very private person. I don't mind being by myself for extended periods of time. When I do get together with my friends, it's usually just one-on-one or just a couple people. So in that way, I'm very much more like my sister, whereas my brothers, social animals. If there's a party going on, they probably want to be at it, not me. And is that environmental or genetic? I don't know. So a lot of similarities, a lot of differences, and it's truly a reflection on being raised by different people, having different life experiences, maybe being pushed or led in certain directions by parents or not led by parents, whatever choice you want to pick there, that has certainly made us all different people. And even among, if I could assess my three siblings, they're all very different people. Certainly. I see them as three very distinct individuals, even though my brother Brian may be similar to my sister Diane in some ways, similar to my brother Michael, but they have a lot of differences. They're surely three distinct people. And I think that if some were to meet all four of us at one time and each of us got equal time to display our personalities and likes and dislikes and everything, I think it would show that we're all four very distinct people, even though we share a lot of the same qualities as well. But certainly anybody wants to do a sociology experiment or study, myself and my three siblings would be a spectacular study, given that they were raised by different parents. I had different parents. And then we all ended up meeting, 25 years later, certainly think would be interesting if somebody wanted to do that. Next question. Do you write out your notes for the interviews and the podcasts, or do you type them on a computer? I'm a huge computer person. Back, of course, well before I ever started Unfound or ever did any podcasting, way back in the 90s when I really started doing some writing, like fiction writing, and this really is something I started in high school, and had an English class where I had to write some short stories, and I always did very well with that. And then I had to do quite a bit of writing in college, and always on any writing assignments, always got graded very, very well. Did not do very well in school, but if there were any writing assignments having to do a study or something like that, like I remember I had a constitutional law class where I had to research specific, they actually gave you the Supreme Court justice that you had to look up and go to the lot, you know, before the internet, had to go to the library and look up. And I did well on that. And so I always did well at writing, but I will tell you that never did I actually ever write anything by hand. First of all, I have horrible handwriting. If any of you have ever seen my signature, that is about as good as my writing gets, and that is horrible. I don't know why that is, but my writing is not good. In fact, when I do crossword puzzles with my dad, he tells me, well, make sure you keep it within the squares and make sure I can understand what the letters are. And he's kind of joking around, but he's kind of telling me the truth. My dad has spectacular handwriting. I have horrible handwriting. So I would never write anything out by hand. But you should know, if all of you don't know this, even to this day, there are many famous authors who write by hand, like with a pencil or pen and pad. They don't sit at a computer and type, which boggles my mind. I cannot imagine doing that. Writing, of course, a novel is going to be, what, 100,000 words or something? But to do the first draft by hand, forget it. Just absolutely forget it. I wouldn't even be able to read my own handwriting. It would just take too long and everything. So when it comes to Unfound, everything's done on computer. It's not even a consideration otherwise. All the notes. And what I do is, how I do this is when I talk to a future guest for the first time, I get permission to record the conversation. And then after I listen to the entire conversation again as it plays, I'm sitting at my computer typing out notes, ideas that come to my mind, maybe things that I think are missed or facts that just aren't clear to me, to do follow-up questions, etc. And then eventually all of that turns into an outline that once again I type out that I send to the guest and that person looks it over. So we all have an understanding of how the conversation is going to go and everything that we're going to cover. I could never do any of that, writing it out with a pen and paper. That would just, oh my gosh, can't even imagine it. So I am fully locked into electronics here, and that is never going to change ever. Never, ever. So, and that's why I have, like, I mean, you have to keep in mind, I guess technically I use four different computers to do this podcast. I have my HP, which is where I do all of my writing and everything. I have my MacBook, which is where I do all of my recording in GarageBand, if you're familiar with that program. And then I have my tablet, which is what I use to record some of the conversations. And then I, of course, have my phone. So I'm locked in to technology for this podcast. Next question, do you play video games? And if so, which ones do you play? The only video game that I play these days is chess on my phone. Never been a big video game person. I had, going back to what, 1981, 82, 83, I had an Atari 2600. And I can remember having sleepovers at my house. You know, boys, friends of mine would come over and they'd bring their Atari cassettes, video games, and would play, you know, late into the night before my mom forced us to all to go to bed. I can remember that. And but really, I got away from it. And the only time I would play any video games is when I would go over to my best friend's house, and they were all brothers, and they had Nintendo, like late 80s, and I'd play Super Mario Brothers and maybe a couple other games. They were all into that. But once again, only when I was over there. And then I got a computer, must have been around 2000 or something, that had the video game Descent on it. It was like a first-person shooter, but you were like in this little spaceship or something. Maybe some of you remember that. And I can remember playing that on my computer. And then there was that video game that a lot of guys at Star Trek were into. It was called Unreal Tournament, where you had these little, once again, kind of first-person shooter, but you were in these, the maps were like, you were like a little person, but you were like in a kitchen or something, but you're just really, really little. And so you could like jump down into the drain of the kitchen or the sink or whatever. Or you were like in an arcade room or a billiards room, and you could go inside the billiards table, stuff like that. And I played that for a while and was kind of into that because some of my friends at Star Trek were into it. But really, since then, that's been it. I think it's no different than with doing Unfound. Like, I love puzzles. I can remember as a kid, we had a my parents had a subscription to the magazine Games. Do you remember that? I don't even know if it still exists. But I loved that magazine. We'd get it. And, of course, there was a lot of stuff in there. It was just so difficult. But I loved it. Loved it. And I still do love, like, word games and puzzles like that. And even if you've ever taken the LSAT to get into law school, that's really what it is. It's a minimum information game. It's like, all right, five people are sat around a table, but this person doesn't sit next to this person, and this person has blonde hair and red hair, and you have to figure out how they're all seated around this table and which who has the correct colored hair. That's what the LSAT is like. I love stuff like that. But doing Unfound, I'd rather get to do real-life puzzles. And that's what I mean. I'm much more of a reality, although I don't watch reality TV. I'm much more of living out here, trying to solve the puzzles and mysteries that actually exist out here in the world, in contrast to solving any on a website or in a magazine or something. And so I think that's the reason that I'm not into video games, that I go play disc golf in real life. I don't play disc golf on a computer. I think that's just the reason. It just doesn't have any meaning to me. It's not real. You know, if you mess up, you can just hit reset. It just is not really a challenge to me. And the other thing is, I think a lot of people get into it because of the camaraderie. Of course, you can do that over the internet, make friends and everything. And like I said, I'm kind of a lone wolf out here. So that figures into it as well. So not a big video game guy. I don't really necessarily have anything bad to say about them. But I would also say that I'm not sure overall. I think it's probably a net positive for society, video games, but I wouldn't say it's a net positive as much as video game people think. How about that? Next question. Like I said, I'm trying to mix these up between like true crime stuff and non-true crime stuff, going back and forth. Did I ever get COVID? I have no idea. It's been over 4 years since that all started, and I've never been tested. I have gotten sick twice. That one time, if you'll remember, back in December when I was up seeing my dad for Christmas, I mean, whew, that was the sickest I've been in a long time. In fact, to the point that I couldn't even record an episode for that Friday, which is the first time I ever missed an episode because I was sick. Just could not. No energy, voice shot, everything else. Was that COVID? No idea. More recently, once again, when I went to see my dad here in March of 2024, that last few days that I was there, got sick again. Certainly not as bad as at Christmas time, but it was no fun. But still, I was able to get the episode recorded. Were either of those COVID? I don't know. I don't know. All I know is those are the only two times in the last 4 years that I've been sick. I'm generally a person who doesn't get sick. And in fact, if you just want to count Florida, I really haven't been sick at all since I moved here in 2011. Now, I've been sick outside of Florida in Pennsylvania twice. But as far as being sick in Florida, like with any coughing and sore throat and headaches and things like that, I certainly have my allergies, which come in February into March. But actual illness, virus, bacteria, or whatever, I haven't been sick in Florida since I moved here. So I maybe one of those sicknesses I had at my, just the recent one or the back one back in December was COVID. I have no idea. Or maybe I got COVID here in Florida and I didn't even know it, which I've heard is possible. So I just don't know. And I have to admit, unless somebody brings up COVID to me, I'm going to be totally honest with you. I know this is bizarre. I kind of forget that it ever happened. It just didn't affect me, given I'm a podcaster, I work from home and everything anyway. You go back to that time of March 2020 for the rest of like 2020, still got episodes done. Didn't affect my work at all, so maybe eventually it was just easier for me to put the whole thing out of my mind than many of you who were greatly, greatly affected by it. But unless somebody... I actually read COVID somewhere, or somebody asks me a question like this, or somebody mentions it, I have to admit there's a large part of me that forgot that it ever happened. Next question. Your ability to lead the interviews in a direct yet courteous way truly amazes me. Thank you. Have you ever had an argument or ended up on bad terms with any guest or potential guest? The answer is yes. Of course, I'm not going to mention any names. First of all, potential guests, yes. Usually, and this is, these are actually, when you say argument, there are people who have stood me up, and that's a whole other topic. That's maybe a little different, but actually disagreements, it happens. And really, usually the reason is that there are things that, you have to understand this, we don't talk about anything in the interviews that the guest doesn't want to discuss. The issue, though, happens is when they want to leave things out that I determine must be talked about, like fundamental facts, something that is just unavoidable. Not only that, but it's actually out there in the public, where if we don't talk about it, then everybody's going to come away from the episode thinking, why didn't they discuss that? And I don't ever want that to happen. Unless it's something like Kooksville, you know, Kookville conspiracy land or something like that. But there, this example that I always give, but there are others, but this is the one that kind of is like the stereotype, is that a guy went missing. He was working for the military. And allegedly, right before he went missing, he had discovered there was some accounting problem in his department in the military. And the family was thinking, well, there was some sort of cover up, and he discovered something, and then, you know, the federal government or somebody, you know, the men in the black suits caused his disappearance. Now, you know me, how much I'm going to buy into some of that, something like that. Not much. However, I was willing to talk about it. We could certainly have a discussion about it, but what I wanted to talk about, though, was the fact that this guy, though, on the other hand, was cheating on his wife and was last seen with his wife's brother. Now, you can certainly understand why I would want to talk about that, because that sounds to me like a bigger reason that this guy, who is still missing to this day, by the way, I think 30 years later, than the government, you know, getting rid of him because of something he allegedly found, an accounting problem. And the thing is, we have to think, the budget for the federal government, I know we're in deficits and everything, but the budget for the federal government's like $5 trillion, and we were talking like a couple million dollars here. Once again, allegedly. The problem was all they wanted to do was talk about the government angle, and they didn't want to talk about the fact that this guy was cheating on his wife and was last seen with his wife's brother. Now, you could see why that wouldn't go well, that I would have to say, well, I just can't do that. This is kind of usually what causes myself and a potential guest to come to an impasse, where it's, the unstoppable force meets the immovable object. They don't want to talk about it. I insist we must talk about it because it, but it'll make me and the podcast, I think, in a way, lose some credibility. And so we can't do it. And we have a disagreement, and that's that. Now, before I move on to talking about maybe a couple guests, once again, no names, where we kind of eventually had a falling out, I will talk about people who are scheduled to do interviews and then just kind of disappear, don't take calls, and don't return texts. That happens to both me and my assistant, Emily, who does a lot of the reaching out to people for Unfound. You would be amazed how much that happens. We just had it recently where a woman, who was it, her brother went missing. She ended up sending Emily all sorts of pictures and wrote this long dissertation about what happened and seemed energetic. And then both me and Emily tried to message her and text her over the next few days. Nothing. And that was like a month ago. Why do these things happen? I don't know. Why do I go through talking to some few potential guests, have this great rapport, and then on the day of the interview, boom, nothing. No call, no text, never talk to him again. I don't know. And then I will try to follow up like a month later. Hey, what happened? Won't get back to me. I have no idea what's going on. If I knew, I would tell you, but I don't. Maybe, I suppose there's a lot of different reasons that could happen, but I couldn't ever even pick out one good reason for that. So that happens regarding potential guests as well. Doing a lot of work and then boom, nothing. It's like we never talked. And no, it's rude. It is rude, rude, rude. And if you don't know me very well, I can put up with a lot of things, but I am not rude. I don't stand people up. You know, if I'm supposed to call somebody at a certain time, I call them. I do not waste people's time. People are never sitting around waiting for Ed Denzel to come through with a promise that he made. I will come through with it when I say I will. It is amazing, though, how many rude people. It's one of those things, you know what? Bad things happen to rude people, I guess, too. Now, as far as people who have actually been on Unfound and then we later had a falling out, it happens. Mainly because of them getting wrapped up with new people. Remember, me, I move on to the next disappearance. I'm always ready to talk to all of the guests who have been on Unfound. But this is what I do. I move on to the next disappearance. That doesn't mean the other 300 behind me don't mean anything to me. They absolutely mean everything to me. But this is what I do. But what happens is that some of these guests get wrapped up with new people. And these people start talking in their ear, giving them different, these people who really, in my opinion, because I kind of, in one way or another, find out who these people are somehow. Because this is what I do. I'm in this business. You know, I think these new people get in these guests' ear. Oh, you should know. That guy doesn't know what he's saying. This is actually what happened. No, that didn't happen. He doesn't know what he's talking about. No, this was definitely a murder, and we're going to prove it for you and everything else. And meanwhile, I'm thinking that's probably not what happened. And they're thinking, well, this is the person who's dealing with me all the time now, but Ed's moved on to all these other disappearances, so what does he care? So I have to start listening to this new person. And then it gets to the point where, you know, because I'm always honest with my guests, which, of course, sometimes can get you in trouble, and I just have to say, I don't think that person knows what he or she is talking about. And then the problems start. because the problem we have is there are too many people out there who are more than happy to tell a family whatever they want to hear. Oh, you believe that your son or daughter was murdered? Oh, we believe that too. Oh, you believe there was some huge conspiracy? Oh, we believe that too. We're going to prove it to you. And we and our human egos and everything, what are we much like to do? We're much likely, more likely to go along with people who agree with us than disagree with us. But the problem is, just because somebody who agrees with us doesn't mean we or they are correct. And so that's usually what happens. There's usually some sort of wedge that is driven between myself and a prior guest. It hasn't happened a lot, but it does. It has happened to the point where, in fact, one prior guest said that she said she just wished that I would get rid of all of the information I ever collected on the disappearance in which she appeared as a guest. That actually happened. Just get rid of it. You know, we're dealing with somebody new now. Okay, good luck with that. So that happened. So I'm not saying I'm a perfect person or anything, but it's easy, I think, for maybe some guests to maybe eventually not like me because I don't tell them what they want to hear. Now, I certainly could be wrong. Certainly. The problem is that these new people that are now in my former guest life, they insist that they're so dang correct. That's the problem. When really, you know, there's not really anybody who can come in and absolutely say 100% that something happened. Moreover, they could say this, but I don't know how they're going, you know, the couple that I'm thinking about, and I don't want to mention any names, I have no idea how they're going to prove that. Despite them saying that they can. I don't know how they're going to do that. So a lot of, are these actual people con people? Some of them are, surely. Surely. And I do what I can, but I can't save everybody. So that's how that all happens. Next question. Do you think that the true crime fans all over America and the world are helping or hurting cases being solved? I would say they aren't helping enough. Certainly true crime, people who take an interest in disappearances and unsolved murders and anything like those topics, millions and millions of people, not just the United States, all over the world. The problem we have is that not enough people are getting engaged, are getting actually involved. They're certainly willing to tune in. I thank all of you who tune in to Unfound every Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. But I wish you would tune in and also get involved. Find out what's going on. Any searches popping up. You know, reaching out to a family near you. Saying, do you need somebody to do something? You know, I've been listening to this podcast. I think I'm learning a few things about disappearances. Is there a way I can help? There are not enough people doing that. Until that starts happening on a greater basis, I think that true crime and the way people outside of it look at it is always going to be a bit negative. You almost, not every week maybe, but every month you can see at least one article written somewhere about saying that people who take an interest in all this stuff, they're not helping, they're trivializing people's pain, they're getting entertainment out of people's pain and people's loss and everything. And certainly there are many, 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 many productions that do that. This is why I continue to say that Unfound is a news program. It's not an entertainment one. It's here. I'm here to inform. The guests are here to inform. We're not here to entertain you. We're here to give you information that hopefully you will act upon yourself. Now, I realize all of you have your own things going on in your lives. I get it. But 1 hour a month, is that too much to ask? So until that starts happening, there will be a perception that this is just something that's being done for the purpose of money. Do I get paid to do this? Yes, but certainly given my experience in a whole bunch of different areas and my intelligence and everything else, I could certainly be making way, way, way more money doing a lot of other things. Truth be known. So I'm certainly not doing it for the money. Although I appreciate all the people who support through Patreon and the advertisers and everybody else. But I think this is also a reason, going back to a question from the first, 30 minutes or something, about the police, you know, law enforcement. Law enforcement obviously needs help regarding disappearances. How do I know? Because there's like 100,000 unsolved disappearances in the United States. You'd think they might look out there amongst the population and say, is there anybody who we think can help outside of our ranks here? And what's funny is that in Texas, they're actually going to be having some program through the Attorney General's office where they're actually going to allow college kids to look at the crime files of like murders and disappearances, cold cases. You know, myself and many other podcasters who take these topics very seriously, we file FOIAs. We can't get our hands on information. But the Texas Attorney General will be more than happy to let a bunch of uneducated, inexperienced college kids look at them. I don't know if that would be happening if the true crime genre and everybody involved in it had a better reputation. So I think we're helping a little bit, but certainly we have the ability to help a lot more, and that a lot of people don't, and they just listen or watch and then they're on with their day until the next Friday or whatever else, I think hurts the overall reputation of the true crime community. There you go. Question: what celebrity would you cast in your biopic to play yourself? Now, this was a question that was posted in the discussion group, and already your people were picking out Jason Bateman. And the reason is that there's a story that goes back, I'm going to guess this was 2013, that I showed up at a disc golf tournament in Orlando, Florida. And there was a player who then got a couple other disc golf players involved. And they thought that I was Jason Bateman. They thought that Jason Bateman, the actor, of course, going way back, what was the second Teen Wolf 2 Money movie and what, you know, whatever else he was in. And then, of course, more recently, Ozark, which is a show I've never seen. And, of course, he was in that movie, Game Night, which is a fantastic movie. Love that movie. Fantastic. Jason Bateman. There are a lot of people who, at least when I had short hair, thought he and I look alike. And I guess I see the resemblance. I would say our noses are – of course, he has much straighter teeth than I do. Maybe I'll get the fix one of these days. But our noses are very different. But other than that, I guess we kind of look alike, at least when I have short hair, which isn't going to be again anytime soon. So that's like the easy answer, but you can never cast him because he and I are like the same age. And if we're really going to do a biopic, are we going to go back? I don't know. I mean, how far do you want to go back to do the story of Ed Densel? Jason Bateman's probably not going to be able to play a young Ed Densel. I'm taking this question, but I can't answer it because I really don't know a lot of young actors. I'm certainly a prisoner of my generation, Generation X, and movies and TV shows. You know, I haven't seen a lot of the Academy Award winning movies that have come out in the last few years or anything. So if we're really going to go back, like, Let's just say even to when I was just 30, like when I got to Las Vegas, when I would have been, what, 27? What's a 27 to 30 some early 30 something year old actor who could play me? Maybe that guy who played Spider-Man or something, but he's Australian. I'd like to, an American, or is he British? I'd like an American guy to play me. I don't want somebody just faking an accent, faking an American accent. I would expect some real American actor to play me, but I just can't pick that person out, because I just am so out of touch with, what is it, Generation Z or millennials or any sort of people who are capable actors in that generation. But certainly, have this been 25 years ago or something, then maybe I think Jason Bateman could have played me, and that would have been kind of cool, I guess, but not now. Certainly not now, but it's a fantastic question. You should know that there are particular actors and actresses who I like, but you won't be surprised that it's a factor of my age. And Robert Downey Jr., fantastic. Even was a fan of him, even, you know, going back to the, you know, with back to the 80s with Weird Science and with Less Than Zero and The Pickup Artist. And of course, he had problems in the 90s. But I think his story about coming back, cleaning himself up and being such a spectacular person and husband and father and leader, and just seems to really have this great moral compass and everything. Fantastic. Everybody knows that I'm a huge fan of Bo Derek and Jennifer Aniston. But once again, these are all Keanu Reeves, all factor of my age. And so really can't pick somebody out who could be in a biopic of me going back so many years, then leading up to the present or wherever my future is going. But it's a fantastic question. I promise to think about it a little bit more. Maybe I'll have a better answer later this year. Next question. Would you ever consider becoming a private detective in order to expand and gather more resources for Unfound? I have to admit, I'm not convinced anything like that would help. All of you by now know my attitude toward private investigators. Very negative attitude. Negative, negative, negative. Certainly, if you want a cheating husband or wife followed, probably a private detective is a good choice. But if you're actually looking for them to gain any more insight into a disappearance and collect more facts, true facts regarding a disappearance, the odds of that happening are very, very low. And I don't care if it's a disappearance that happened a month ago or a year ago or 10 years ago. I don't think it matters. This is no different than what I say just about public detectives, investigators, actually people who are actually in law enforcement, who carry guns and can arrest people and handcuff people. Just don't have the experience. They don't have that, what I call, talk about the Rolodex. Me doing this podcast, I have a Rolodex of disappearances in my mind. All of the ones that are featured on Unfound. Now, granted, I may lose, because of the human mind, I may lose a few details here and there, but I have a general idea of about disappearances and why they happen. And the statements that families make, the statements that suspects make, and about what witnesses, how witnesses say, how witnesses act, and what they say, and circumstances, and all of these other things. What's up in my head is not in any investigator's mind in the United States at all. Zero. They have nothing to tap into in their mind when they show up to fill out the paperwork for a missing persons case. Same way with private detectives. Same thing. They got nothing. It's like, what, a 21st century cliche, or gotten into the lexicon lingo or whatever, I got nothing. That's the way they are. Of course, they're not going to say that because they want to get paid. The other issue I have is that I look at, if you're going to be a private detective, then there should be some sort of guarantee. I look at it no different than a plumber. If you have a problem with your sink, you call the plumber, and the plumber shows up and doesn't fix it, the plumber doesn't get paid. The plumber is getting paid to fix the problem. The plumber is not getting paid. I realize that, well, just for me to show up, it's $150 an hour. Well, yeah, good luck trying to cash that in if you can't fix it. I'll cancel that credit card charge in a second. I give you a check, I'll cancel that check if you can't fix it and you're just going to leave. You wouldn't pay a plumber if the person just shows up, can't fix it. So for private investigators, though, what? They want paid no matter if they bring anything to a conclusion or not. And so this is one of those, I don't know if it's certainly not a legal thing. I don't know if it's a moral thing, but it's certainly an ethical thing. Is it right to get paid and not fix something? This is different than a police investigator, because a police investigator is going to get paid no matter if a disappearance happens or not. They're salaried. So I also think about that I have a problem with that. There's nothing in my experience that tells me you need to be a private investigator to do these sort of things. In fact, it seems like it's a detriment. It's just my perception. Certainly, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be private detectives. Like I said, there are probably many things that you could use them for. You're not going to get the police to follow a cheating husband around. You're not. In addition, it's probably not healthy if you're a wife and you think your husband's cheating on you to hire your brother to do it, because who knows what might happen there. Somebody might end up getting murdered or something. So I can understand wanting a third party to do that. It makes all the sense in the world to me. But they have experience in that. And my guess is these people are going to get what they paid for. They're looking for evidence. They're looking for pictures and anything like that of the cheating husband with the stripper at the pay-by-the-hour motel. Private detectives are really, really good at that. For disappearances, which are way more complicated, it's just so the answer is no. And even on top of that, of course, there are states where you don't need any criteria to become a private detective. Zero. You just go out and fill up some paperwork. Boom, you're a private detective. Congratulations. Here in Florida, it's actually fairly complicated to become a private detective. Either way, I really don't think it matters. None of it has anything to do with missing persons cases or knowing anything about missing persons cases. Me being a private detective, like it says here, gather more resources. Would it be easier for me to get police files on disappearances? I don't think there's any guarantee of that. In addition, we've covered some disappearances where private investigators were involved, and I actually got to see the work that the private investigator did. Here's for all of you. Private detectives are just as likely to get caught up in all these crazy, crazy, complex, conspiratorial hoaxes as the general public is. That's what I've seen in the paperwork that I've seen that has been given to me. So certainly we need more great people being private detectives, but for me personally and what I do, I don't think it would help at all. If you actually want to help people with those things that they can't do themselves, like cheating spouses and whatever other things private detectives could do, kind of investigations that the police aren't going to do, but it might be dangerous for private people to do, or just regular family members or some just layperson, then I get it. But for what I do, I just don't see it as being helpful. And that concludes part one of Q&A episode number 6. Please now find part 2 in your podcast application. I'm Ed Densel, and you've been listening to Unfound.